Why is it important to have people to doubt what they believe?
Because if everybody is confident in what they believe, that's how you get authoritarianism. That's how you get people wanting big sticks and guns, killing other people who don't believe. That's how you get a kind of moral righteousness that's unjustified. And when you live in a democracy, you need to make certain kinds of compromises.
我是范肥，
我是娃娃，
欢迎收看《匪夷所思》哦。那今天我们阿姨想知道，我们请到了一位很难得的客人啊，是一位美国的教授 Peter Boghossian。他其实在美国超有名 ，OK， 超有名的原因是因为他真的非常的争议啦。那我会知道他的原因，是因为那时候那个好机车的唢呐嘛，哦，他做的一个影片。他在影片里面呢，我就看到 Peter Boghossian 在美国的大学校园里面跟学生论战的那个经过这样子，哦，我觉得真的超级的精彩。那个影片呢，其实最重要的，他其实就在挑战这些大学生的价值观，而且这些都是自由派为主的这些校园了啊，所以他就问他们很多有关于，比如说性别啦，在认同上面啦，还有种族议题上面这样子。那你在听他们这个交锋的这个过程里面，你就会看得出来，哇，这个信仰哇有点太极端了。
而且我觉得很有趣的是，你就会看到 Peter 他一直都非常冷静，然后很冷静的问问题，但对方就会开始越来越被他激怒。
对，你就看到对方越来越严重，越来越张牙舞爪，声音越来越大声，这样子非常非常的有趣啊。然后另一方面呢，他对于美国的高等教育非常的不满，他觉得哈佛这些常春藤学校这一套全部都不灵啊。来，这个吉娃娃，你有看到他的这个研究，你跟大家讲一下。
好，那反正就是 Peter 在2017年的时候跟其他两位教授，他们就想要来做一个学术的恶作剧。那他们就是写了很多篇这个论文，然后基本上里面内容都是一些乱讲话啦，就是他可能就只是用一些很专业的术语啊，然后引一些很有credibility 的一些文献，然后就把它写出来，但其实就是里面内容都是一些完全没有逻辑然后很荒唐的内容，零零总总有写了20几篇，那最后有7篇获得期刊的认可。那他们做这件事情就是想要挑战说，就是其实美国的学术可能有一些乱象，那可能他们的审查没有那么严谨，毕竟这些都是可能会被人家拿去做研究或是引用的期刊嘛。那还有一个重点就是说，是不是我们现在所相信的这些学术理论啊，是不是其实并没有经过那么严谨的证实或是研究所得出来的结论，就是他们做这件事情想要达到的目的啦。
嗯，然后 Peter 做的这些实验里面呢，另外一个非常重要的一个部分呢，就在讲说你怎么样去跟不同的意见的人谈话啊。其实我在看的时候，我是真的觉得，就是大家现在都对自己的意见非常的强烈的这个坚持这样子。那他是怎么样去跟一个有坚强信仰的人，或甚至是已经到非常极端信仰的人去跟他们交谈，然后甚至可以让他们开始自我怀疑说，诶，也许我这样想是有问题的，我觉得超厉害的啊。那刚好呢，这个几个月以前呢，他就这个唢呐嘛，就告诉我说，这个 Peter 要来台湾，我就很兴奋啊，我就想说，哇，这个一定要赶快请他来。而且他这次来台湾呢，就是要跟我们台湾的年轻的朋友们，还有我们民众哦，就是要谈谈统独啦、两岸议题这样子。所以我也真的很好奇 ，Peter 在台湾，他现在已经，我们做访问的时候，他已经在台湾2-3个礼拜了哦。所以我不知道说他在跟台湾的观众谈了之后，他对于我们台湾的观众的想法又是什么。好，那今天我们就赶快来听听这个 Peter Boghossian 他是怎么说的吧。All right, so Peter, say hi to our audience.
Hello, everybody. Nice to be here.
So Peter, I know about you is because your experiment, spectrum street epistemology.
Oh, correct.
I cannot even pronounce it's, English.
I know. Even
this
English
is
people.
It's so even, hard.
I know.
Okay, so tell us, tell us why do you have this idea to do this experiment?
Well, I wrote about street epistemology in my first book. It's how to help people make their ideas clear.And I did my dissertation in the prisons with prison inmates, and I had a version of this in which I helped prison inmates think critically and reason morally so that they would stop committing crime. And then I took those tools and I applied them to hardcore religion, faith in particular, hardcore faith, and then my last book, I broadened it to conversations. But the problem in the United States is people aren't talking to each other. They don't know how to talk to each other. They're not having it modeled for them in college, or they're having exactly the opposite thing modeled, that they're so fragile. If someone says something, they should be offended. They should report it to the dean, or... And so they don't really understand how to have a difficult conversation. So Spectrum Street Epistemology is a way to both help them make their ideas clear, to see if they have enough evidence to justify their confidence, and to speak across a divide, political, sexual, cultural, moral, epistemological, any kind of divide that people have.
So this time in Taiwan, you also, you know, you try to talk to people using this model, right? So tell us, what do you do in Taiwan so far? And what do you ask people?
Besides eat, what do I do?
Yeah, exactly.
We're a hot pot, big fan. So we went to University of New Taipei, and we're going to go again, I think, this Friday. And we set something up outside the library, and we will ask them questions about, a lot of questions about China, Taiwan. What do you think will happen? What should happen? Should there be unification? If there is a blockade... This is the question that really shocked a lot of people. But if China blockades or invades Taiwan, and if Taiwan, which Taiwan does not, but if Taiwan had nuclear weapons, would it be morally justified to initiate a tactical nuclear strike on Shanghai or Beijing? Mm-hmm. And most,
and what did people say?
Most of the people said no. Some said yes. And then what we do is we ask them for their reasoning. So they'll stand on a line, strongly disagree, disagree, slightly disagree, neutral, and then the other side for agree. And then people will walk to a mat to see, and then we'll ask them, independent of what mat they walk to, we'll ask them questions about why they think that. Do they have enough evidence and what have you?
Let's practice that.
Okay, so let me ask the question again.
That's right.
So I want you to give me, we don't have Matt, so give me a number from 1 to 10. 1 means absolutely not, 5 means maybe, 10 means absolutely yes.
Okay.
So if China were to militarily invade Taiwan, and if Taiwan had nuclear weapons, would they be justified in a tactical nuclear strike on Shanghai?
No. So my answer will be, so the
I need a number now.
Yeah, I 2. How about that?
Okay, so let's go with the 2 for a moment.
Okay.
So what if the invasion meant that the people of Taiwan would live under a tyranny for generations?
Well,
no free speech, mm-hmm. no free press, no free assembly, no free elections.
For me, to launch a nuclear weapon and then instantly kill millions of people is just definitely worse. I just cannot make myself, no matter what, to go down that road. I just couldn't imagine myself make the decision.
Then you and your daughter and son and their grandchild and their children living in under tyranny with no freedoms for generations.
That's right. I could only hope that maybe in the future they will find a way to fight it out.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. So one of the reasons that North Korea and Iran are acquiring nuclear weapons is because they know they won't be invaded.
Right.
Because they know because the consequences.
They have, mm-hmm.
Right. So
I know the theory.
Right. So is that calculus applicable to Taiwan?
Yes. That's why it's a 2, because I think we should have nuclear weapons, but it's for deterrence. But I also understand that strategically, if you tell China or the whole world, we are not going to use it, which means that it's useless.
Right. So then they're not a deterrent.
That is not a deterrent. So, but you know, your question is, when Taiwan got attacked, would I launch the nuclear weapon in Shanghai?
Or Beijing.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I won't do that. I would hold a nuclear weapon as a leverage.
If you really want it to be a deterrent, you would not only have to say that you would use it, but be willing to use it.
Yes, you have to claim that.
Okay, so...
Which means that I have to lie.
You would either have to lie, or you'd have to convince people that they should use it, because if not, it increases the likelihood of attack. So do you agree that if Taiwan had nuclear weapons technology and was willing to use it, the Chinese would be less likely to invade?
I believe so.
Okay, so I think that's a common sense position. Mm-hmm. So let's take that as true. Is that a reason to develop nuclear weapons? And would that be a reason to use them if in the case of an invasion?
I won't do it.
Okay, then it's not a deterrent.
It's not. It's a deterrence when you don't tell them you are not going to use it. But if you tell them, when you hold it and you say, I'm just not going to use it, of course, it's useless. But I think we should have that ability. We should have that weapons in our hands. Only when you have that power, then people will listen to you.
Okay, so what would the argument be for someone who's, for example, said 9? Like, what would their reasoning look like?
9?
Yeah.
I think for them, they just, I think to protect yourself or your family, I think is human nature.
So is it that you don't want, the reason you would say no is because you don't want millions of casualties, millions of deaths, which would what it would probably look like.
Right. I couldn't imagine myself go down that road.
But you could imagine yourself and your staff and your office and everybody you love and everybody you know being enslaved.
I would rather be that.
But you couldn't imagine mass murdering people, but you could imagine everyone you love being enslaved.
So
it's worse than for you. Correct me I just want to make sure I understand your reasoning. It's worse for you to kill people that you don't know than it is for everyone you love to be enslaved in perpetuity.
Yes, for me it's like that.
Okay. Yeah. So then we now know at the conclusion we can temporarily conclude the exercise and say that you have sufficient, maybe not evidence, but sufficient reasoning that you've thought through the position to justify the two. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be that we come back tomorrow or we hang out or we have a drink or what have you, and then you say, well, you know, I've really been thinking about this and turns out I'm not a 2, I'm a 1, right? I'm even more convinced or I'm really not a 2, I'm a 7.
I could change my position.
Right. What would it take to change your mind?
I think when the day we really got invaded, when we see the bomb falling down in Taipei, a lot of people died. And, you know, just see the casualties when you, like, you know.
So you would have to actually see that. So are you familiar at all with how the Chinese torture political dissidents?
I think we heard, yes, we did. We actually invite some of them come to the show before. Yeah. So I do know that. So I think I do know some of that. Yeah.
So some of those reports are they keep them in extraordinarily small cages, like a chicken cage, and they line them up and they just poop on each other and they just can't move for years on end. Mm-hmm. So would it change your mind if you saw someone you loved treated like that by the Chinese?
It's possible.
So would you then, if you saw that, would you be willing to move from a 2 to a 6 or a 2 to a 5?
It's possible.
So if you went on a tour of the places of the Chinese internment camps or where they keep the Uyghurs or where they torture people, as institutionally torture people, that would be sufficient to change your mind, perhaps?
It's possible. I see that coming.
I guess my question to you then is, so to you, it's worse to kill people than it is to see them tortured to death.
I think no matter what, we should try to put lives at first. You know, so if you got tortured but you're not dead yet. A lot of people, I think, yes, I understand that. You know, a lot of people say that without freedom, I'd rather not live. But I won't do that. I won't make the decision for.
So that's a moral decision that
you've
made.
It's a moral decision. Yeah, for myself, I can only say that it's for myself. I cannot make that decision for everyone.
So that was going to be my next question. So I understand if you say for yourself that you would rather be kept in a chicken cage and tortured for the rest of your life. I understand that. But I guess the thing that I'm trying to understand is by what moral authority. How do you cede moral authority to let tyrants do that to people you love?
I don't have moral authority. I don't have that. I don't see anybody have the moral authorities to
do
that.
But by saying that you won't launch nuclear weapons against people who are enslaving the people you love, and this is all hypothetical, of course.
Right, of course.
I'm just trying to see, like, what... under what conditions you'd be willing to change your mind. So that's one of the things we do in street epistemology.
Right, okay.
We posit these hypotheticals. Some of them are wild, some of them are out there, but it's a way to test your belief. It's a way to see if the number you gave me two is actually two. When we ask hypotheticals like that, it enables people to think about if the reason and evidence they have for the position they gave is justified.
So do you think that this work on like everyone, or is that particularly somebody who is like difficult to have this kind of discussion?
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to have this discussion with most people.
Most people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because most people are not willing to change their mind on something that they have a strong attachment to, specifically if it's an identity characteristic. They're just, they're not willing to... So in this conversation, every time I threw a hypothetical at you, you just accepted it. Mm-hmm. Some people, they just can't accept hypotheticals. My friend Doug said to me something that's been haunting me. He said, people who are less intelligent are less capable of engaging hypotheticals. So hypotheticals are part of it. People need to be honest. So when Mormons, for example, send two people to the door to proselytize, one of the reasons that they do that is because they don't want the other person to be talked out of the faith. So often when you put people on lines or you play the spectrum street epistemology game with them, if their friends are there, they're less likely to change their minds. So because they want to belong more than they want to be right. They want to signal to someone else their membership in a community and their virtue.
I believe that you ask the liberals and then you ask the conservatives,
yeah.
Right? Do you feel this kind of two groups of people, their reactions are different, or it doesn't matter with their political background?
It's a terrific question. Younger people, especially younger people on college campuses, are looking for a reason to be offended. It is a, I don't want to say unique, but it certainly appears to me to be a unique phenomenon in the United States, in college campuses of people of a certain age. Now, when you become more granular and you look at that in terms of political orientation or ideology, I don't think that the axis to think about it is liberal and conservative or right and left. I think the axis is whether or not you accept certain conditions of woke ideology or critical social justice. And if you do, then certain things are more likely to be follow. For example, you're less likely to change your mind. Or it's very similar to people who are religious fanatics. They're almost definitely will not change their mind. And some of that is for, much of that is for what they perceive to be a moral reason.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that who, like people who like have like really firm belief on something, these kind of people are very hard to talk to.
No, I found everybody easy to talk to.
Okay.
It's if they have the disposition to change their mind. Some people think that if I change my mind on this, I'll be a bad person. Mm-hmm. Good people believe this. I believe that I'm a good person. I believe this. That's the syllogism. So many people want to show everybody else that they're a good person. Good people believe this. I'm telling you, I believe this. I want you to know I'm a good person. That's part of the thinking. But if it's something nobody cares about, like how many ounces of water are in that bottle, people will change their mind about that, no problem.
Okay.
But because that's an empirical thing, it's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's, you know, abortion is less so, should the United States have a closed border, open border? That's another thing. Should the United States come to the aid of Taiwan if it's attacked by China? That's another thing. So those are moral, there's a moral calculus involved there. And as that moral calculus slides into my identity group, then you're less likely to change your belief.
So what do you do that at that time? You know, when you encounter these kind of people, what do you do?
Well, a bunch of things. One, the question I ask you, what would it take for you to change your mind? And did you notice I asked, what would it take for you to change your mind to go to a one? So it wasn't just what would it take for you to change your mind to go to a three or a five. But so that's the one thing you ask. The other thing, question
I... Put yourself in a different situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I asked you why you believe that. But basically, the problem, I only did that to demonstrate it, but the problem with me asking you that is you gave me a reason, which then you convinced yourself that two is the right number. So that's, so usually there are many ways to do it. And you could say to someone, well, if someone didn't believe that, would that make them a bad person? So you can kind of sever the tether between the belief and their conception of what it means to be a good person. Do you know who Miley Cyrus is?
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't identify one song, but I released a video. It only got like nothing, like 5,000 views. I don't usually do children, the street epistemology with children, because there are legal issues if you're under 18 and you want to film someone. Her mom wanted us to engage her. And so the claim was Miley Cyrus was the best artist. And she stood on strongly agree. And I think after like 4 or 5 minutes, I got her to the agree, or she got herself to the agree through questions. If she were older, I would have tried to move her to the, or given her tools to move her to the slightly agree, but I stopped there because of her age. But what's interesting about that is when you instill doubt in people, like that took me over a quarter of a century to learn how to do that in 5 minutes, to take a young teenage girl, give her the tools to help her question a fundamental belief she has about a musician. Mm-hmm. Like, that is very complicated stuff. It's a kind of asking people a question, or targeted Socratic questions, or series of questions, or questions in certain ways with a certain disposition or way to ask them those questions, that makes it so that they're more receptive to being honest with you about what they believe.
So the exercise is not aimed to get the right answer, right?
Yeah, is the confidence you have in a belief justified by the reason and evidence you have? And more often than not, you'll find the answer is probably not. No, people will extend the confidence in the belief beyond the warrant of the evidence. Like and usually, you know, if they have 6 evidence for something and I say on a scale from 1 to 10, where are you? Ideally, that would be 6. But if they say any number other than 6, it's usually higher. So let's say that someone says 9, but they only have 6 evidence. Then you have a problem, right? Mm-hmm. Then they have to pretend, or they have to make stuff up to get from the 6 to the 9. And if they're really honest with themselves, then they'll lower their confidence as opposed to just pretend to know things they don't know.
I often have questions like this. People who say, how do I talk to people with different beliefs?
I'm going to tell you this, and people are going to say, oh God, of course, but almost no one does this. The first thing is you have to listen to the extent that you truly understand what they're talking about. You don't deliver a message. You don't tell them why they're wrong. You truly listen to figure out if you understand. And then what you do is you repeat back to them and you put it on yourself. Oh, is this what you mean? Do I have this right? Did I understand this correctly? So you put the burden of understanding yourself. And then you see what they say. Yes, no, kind of. And if they say anything other than yes, then you have to ask more questions to figure out what they mean. What you're looking for in hostage negotiations, the hostage negotiators look for that's right. If someone says that's right after you've repeated back something, then you know you've nailed it. You have it 100%. So that's one thing you can do. You can listen and then repeat back. And then the other thing is you can shift from thinking about what you believe to thinking about what I did with you. Then I always ask them for a scale. So once I know I understood what they're talking about, I'll ask people how confident they are. And then you can do a lot of things. What would it take for you to go up? What would it take for you to go down? You know, what would it take for change your mind? In all of these cases, the thing you're not doing at all is I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm trying to truly listen to what you say and figure out how you know that. Mm-hmm. How do you know Jesus Christ is the Son of God? How do you know Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead? How do you know that every disparity in outcome is due to systems? Like, what is your evidence for that? One of the goals is to instill doubt, to give people the gift of doubt, to make them more humble about what it is that they think they know.
Mm-hmm. Why is it important to have people to doubt what they believe?
Because if everybody is confident in what they believe, that's how you get authoritarianism. That's how you get people wanting big sticks and guns, killing other people who don't believe. That's how you get a kind of moral righteousness that's unjustified. And when you live in a democracy, you need to make certain kinds of compromises. But all of that said, I believe that nobody wants to believe things that are false. That's Socrates' position as well.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to believe false things. They just believe things because they have different, either they have different evidence or they were taught from their community that if you believe this, we have to believe this because we're the chosen people. We're the good people. We're the right people. We're the moral people. We're virtuous people. And so we have to believe this. And then we have to convert others to make them believe it too. Mm. Because we want them to be good too.
So I'm going to go back to the new Taipei City, the experiment that you went there to talk, right? So that day, tell us more about what happened, the conversation you had over there.
Well, again, we talked a lot about China and Taiwan. We talked, some guy said basketball is the best sport. I think we talked about that. Mm. We talked about vegetarianism, just whatever issues are on people's mind. I think we talked about, whether or not you should, Mandarin is a colonizer language and we should go back to Taiwanese.
So do you think Taiwanese people, we can open up easily, or are we willing to talk honestly?
Boy, I don't know. I have such limited exposure. I don't know is the answer, but I will tell you what people have told me off camera. And that is, they're much less likely to give an honest opinion about something if it relates to China because they're afraid of repercussions.
So when you guys talk about China, you found that people feel uncomfortable to answer honestly.
Correct.
So you have been you've been to different cultures, right? So,
yeah.
Is there any country particularly hard to talk to?
Yeah, United States, college kids.
Oh. Why? You said that because they are so set on what they believe.
Because they've never heard the other side of an issue, because the teachers look at the classroom as an indoctrination factory. The university system is a complete catastrophe. It's teaching them, it's giving them literally backwards roadmaps to reality. It's teaching them how not to talk to, it's teaching them that they're better people if they don't talk to people with whom they disagree. It's teaching them that there are right answers to moral questions, and here they are. It's like a catechism.
You mean schools? I mean, you know, the...
Yeah, K-12, colleges and universities, they've all been ideologically captured.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think that the high education in the United States actually are making the situation worse?
That's the most charitable thing you can say about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kindest thing you can say about it.
Okay. All right. So what do you think? How do we change this then? How can we change this?
You burn the whole system down, all of it, all legacy institutions, you completely destroy them and you build anew.
It sounds a bit extreme, don't you think?
Well, let me ask you a few questions, if I may.
Okay.
Is it better to learn a process that will take you away from reality or to look at a wall?
To look at the wall.
Okay, then there's the answer to your question. So,
right.
Building new things takes time. I'm a faculty member at the University of Austin. Let me just say two things. So, yes, building new things takes time. Yes, building new things takes money. So at the University of Austin, we are building new things. We're building something absolutely extraordinary. We can see from the number of applicants. We can see from the faculty. But I also want to say, if somebody wants to take their time to try to fix a system that I personally believe is irrevocably broken, if that's how someone wants to spend their time, then I want them to succeed. The other thing is, the institutions are already doing this to themselves. We don't have to do anything to them. We just have to let them fall. Mm-hmm. We just have to not correct them.
So you don't believe in the high education in the United States then? You think the system, the whole system is broken?
I mean, just look at Harvard. Harvard is an unmitigated catastrophe. Unmitigated catastrophe. Claudine Gay was found guilty of plagiarism. She was found innocent by an internal investigation before the investigation was even conducted. The university brought pressure with lawyers on the news outlets to not publish about her plagiarism. They know she's a serial plagiarist. They kept her on. Instead of revoking her PhD, or at the very least her job, she's removed from president, but she keeps a $900,000 a year job. The chief diversity officer, caught for plagiarism. The chief Title IX officer caught for plagiarism. But people are terrified because of the race, of the racial issues. Three of these people were African-Americans, and then the fourth was, three or four were black women. So they're afraid of racial. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an unmitigated catastrophe.
I would say that a lot of people in the rest of the world still believe that, like, universities like Harvard are producing the greatest minds of the United States.
Well, that's because they had produced them. Those are legacy. Those are past. Now, the average grade at Harvard is a 3.85. So almost everybody who does there, if you looked at the, so it's not, this is something that will definitely interest your audience. If you just looked at merit and you took race out of it entirely, over 51% of applicants would be Asian. That's more than half of applicants would be Asians. Whites would drop a little bit, Hispanics would drop, and blacks or African Americans would go from 13% to 0.9%, under 1%. So we know that we're putting people in, we're admitting and matriculating and graduating people who are simply unqualified. Mm-hmm. By their own standards, not my standards. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say one more thing that's important. The very same people who are frothing at the mouth about equity and, you know, race, et cetera, the very same people have legacy admissions. You know, when, if your father or mother went there, you get a certain number of points to go there. So these people are complete hypocrites. Mm-hmm. They're really just, they're just a public disgrace.
I know there's another very famous experiment that you did. It's called grievance studies,
right?
That got you into a lot of trouble. But but right. Tell us, why you want to do that, and then tell us what happened.
Well, it was blatantly obvious that academic literature is completely corrupt. In psychology, for just as one example, 50% of papers cannot be replicated in psychology. So I really need you to think about this. This is incredibly profound. So if a clinician wants to go into a clinical setting, a psychologist, and help patients, it's a coin flip. 50% of the techniques that of the peer-reviewed literature, of the studies, cannot be replicated. Mm. That's an astonishing statistic. So taking a step back from that, we realized that there was corruption in the literature. We attempted to show there was corruption. We published, James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose and I published a series of ludicrous articles, many of which were morally reprehensible, to say the least, and completely disgusting. Those papers were published. But instead of the response being, wow, you know, maybe the discipline is off the rails, maybe we need to take an honest look and see if there's ideological bias here, maybe we need to be more honest about the kind of scholarship we're accepting and what the purpose is. No, instead, they attack me. They attacked us. They attacked the project. It's the whole thing. I mean, that it's hard to convey to people how completely ideologically corrupt the system is. Because they'll say, well, no, you're a conspiracy theorist. Well, now they don't say it. Now everybody agrees with me. But, you know, years ago they would say, well, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist, or this will never get out of the university, or these are just a few faculty members, or these are just a few fringe departments, or these are just a few fringe departments in a few universities. So it went from that to it's in college, but it's not going to leak out. Now it's everywhere. It's literally everywhere. It's the whole society is consumed by it. I mean, now they want to think about how insane this is. Now, pilots will get in based upon skin color. Like, that becomes a condition for whether or not surgeons, physicians, like, this isn't a joke. Like, the person operating on you could be there, or in fact is likely there, especially if they're a younger hire, not because they got there from their own merit, but because of the color of their skin.
So do you think that's only liberals' problem then?
I don't agree. Just so you know, I don't agree with the term liberal anymore. I think that that's a term maybe 20 years ago. It had a lot of cachet and traction. I don't think that's the right way to think about it anymore. Okay. But I mean, I'll answer the question with that in mind if you want. But I don't think liberal and conservative are the right way to look at it. In fact, ideology is anti-liberal. Mm-hmm. Because liberalism doesn't discriminate against people on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. This ideology explicitly discriminates people. It literally targets them because of their race. Mm-hmm. Asian, no. Black, yes. Jew, no. That there's nothing, not only is that nothing liberal about that, that's the most anti-liberal thing you can think of.
How would you describe that then? You know, if you are going to
authoritarian. they're authoritarians. There are people who want liberty, and there are people who want merit, and there are people who want freedom, and there are people who don't. And it's a pretty clear distinction. Some of those people have some of those people have a kind of traditional right-leaning bias, and some of those people don't. When you look at that access, there are people who want you to believe certain things, there are people who want you to think certain things, and there are people who want you to pay a price economically, socially, etc., for not believing what they believe. And the most disturbing thing about this is not that those people believe that, because of course in any society you're going to have people believe that, obviously, but it's how many other people are cowards and are unwilling to stand up to those people who are tyrants, who are actively working to undermine the meritocracy and to undermine their freedom to think, believe, and say what they want. They are literally rewriting speech codes. These people are tyrants. There's literally nothing liberal about them. They're the most anti-liberal group of people you can think of.
We interview a lot of the scholars. Some of them are American. Some of them are like Taiwanese. They went to United States and have education over there. I think most of them agree that, the American system still like a triumph. They are still better in creativity.
So that you know, just so that you're aware of this, that that's a white supremacist trope as well, that Asians aren't good at creativity, that creativity, Matt Hale, this is a white, I'm telling you, this is a white supremacist trope. This is common among white supremacists. I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying that the system does or doesn't create that. Certainly the entrepreneurial spirit in the United States is extraordinarily strong. And the way that our systems are set up to incentivize entrepreneurship are very, very strong. But when I say that the society is suffering from some very severe problems, I don't mean to say that it's endemic across all disciplines and all fields. There are certain bright lights among those. I mean, certainly in the United States, research universities and STEM universities are excellent, but even those are undermined by diversity statements. Even those are undermined by attempting to get people with certain exogenous characteristics like their race, their transgender status, attempting to put that in the promotion and tenure basket or even hire them in the first place. All of that is demeaning to the meritocracies. All of it. And we know exactly how to fix it. It's not a mystery at all.
So do you think that people are alarmed by that? Do you think you are alone on this path?
This is a fantastic question. So I asked Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute a similar question. She gave me a great answer. The reason that people, Americans in general, tolerate this is because they think this is amazing, is because they don't understand the degree of the disparity. They don't understand the degree of disparity, for example, in standardized test scores among Blacks and Ashkenazi Jews. They do not understand how extreme that disparity is. So they probably think, oh, it's just a little bit, it doesn't make a difference. Oh, but it makes a huge difference if you want to say that merit matters to outcome. And of course you do, because you might need surgery or your kid might need surgery. You want, you know, as I recently said on a show, if you want to see if someone actually believes this, don't ask them, oh, hey, if you want surgery, would you want to go to someone who is, you know, affirmative action? Don't ask them that. Ask them where they'd want their child to go. That's when you get a real answer. I don't believe that anybody who is a parent, I truly do not believe that anybody who is a parent would want to send their kid either on a plane with someone who is hired by something, anything other than, by anything other than merit, or to a surgeon who achieved that position by anything other than merit. No person who's a parent would ever say, oh, it doesn't make any difference. I don't believe them. I call them out. I think they're liars.
So is there any like people, I mean, actually any universities are doing something to correct this?
Yeah. University of Austin, the university where I'm a founding faculty fellow and faculty advisor, we're completely building a university from scratch.
So what do you guys do differently?
Oh, it's a University of Austin. It's a truth-based institution. There is no diversity hiring. There's no, it's 100% whoever gets in. It's a merit-based system. We let in the best people independent of their race. Race has nothing to do, trans status has nothing to do with the admissions criteria. If you are Asian and you happen to meet the best, great, welcome. It has to be necessary that if you truly want an institution, an elite institution that creates bold people, leaders, risk takers, educated people, you have to have a minimum that you're honest with people about why they're accepted to the institution. And that is whatever the hiring criteria are. And not because your ancestors have been oppressed or kept as slaves X number of years ago, therefore you're entitled to some kind of special dispensation. No, I mean, that's insane.
Do you still have confidence about American?
No, none, zero.
Oh my God, okay.
None. We're marching toward hospice. We're doing this to ourselves. We can't support or secure our border. It's a disgrace. We have people pouring in the country that we have no idea. We've not vetted these people. They could be murderers, rapists, pedophiles. We have no idea who this are. The Republicans have done no better on securing the border. Trump didn't do well on securing the border. Doesn't matter what administration is in power. We've increased the debt. We have now an inability to pay off our national debt, which is now $34 trillion and rapidly increasing, which is why you see people going to Bitcoin. We have wholesale capture of our ideological institutions. No one's talking about it, or people are talking about it, but no one's effectively fighting at large scale. I mean, I just even touched on some of the issues. I'm very bearish on the United States right now.
Okay.
And the important thing to understand is that we need, in a democracy, you are responsible. We need to take a good look in the mirror and see who did this to us. And it's not China. It's us. We did this to ourselves.
So a lot of people would say that the American system would correct itself.
We'll see.
So you don't believe in it?
No.
You don't think so?
All of these problems are correctable, 100% correctable, if you're not looking at a $34 trillion debt. They're all correctable. How on earth? We can't even pay that off. And we're printing money like it's nothing. We're printing money. The United States is the default currency right now. What happens when that's not the case? What happens when oil isn't traded in dollars anymore? And nobody cares. Nobody cares. Okay, well, you know, you don't care, then you'll see what's going to happen. You'll see what's going to happen when you default on your bonds. You don't give a shit? Great. We'll see what happens. You want to lay at the beach? You want to talk about Taylor Swift or whatever? Great. You talk about Taylor Swift all you want. Reality will come for you.
All right. I guess that's it for us today. 我们讲一下 takeaway 好了啦哈。很多人听完这个 Peter 的言论之后，很多人都会直接讲，就是说啊，他对这个进步派攻击这么多，他一定是右派的。我说实在，我第一次听他的那个看到他的那个影带的时候，那时候就有人这样跟我讲。可是我真的，我第一时间就可以判断，他绝对自己就是一个自由派。只有自由派自己人才可以把自己的这一边的这个弱点可能那么
清
楚，真的，而且讲了非常的，真的是正中核心啦。他今天的这个对谈里面，我说真的，我自己有很多长期很相信的东西，是我觉得蛮颠覆的，有好多个想法，真的是这让我要多想一点。比如说，包括我们非常相信，比如说多元化一定是好的，这个一定是好的，这个是不用被挑战的。可是今天听完他讲以后，我觉得 ，Well， 也有个极限吧，哈，即使是如此，也有个极限吧。然后，而且的确是让我再回头去想。多元化一定是好的吗？另外，它一个挑战到的
价值观，
或者是说我们以前不会想太多的，就是美国的高等教育现在在全球还是领先地位，一定很厉害这件事情。他讲完以后，我就对于这些常春藤学校，有扣一点分。我自己有啦，我就有扣一点分。哇，这个学术这样子太不严谨了啊 ！All right， 然后呢，另外一个我觉得，的确，我觉得他对我来讲最重要的就是说，他提醒我一件事啊。就是说我觉得我们每个人都应该要有信仰，因为你要相信一些事，你才会认真，才会很有热情的去往这个方向前进嘛，哈。可是我觉得挑战你的信仰是重要的，就是在这个过程里面要不停的挑战你的信仰，当你的信仰经得起这个考验的时候，你这个信仰才会更坚强。另外一个我觉得 其实我也要再讲一遍哈，我觉得像 Peter 这样对美国这么不看好的也算是很少数啦，因为美国目前不管怎么样讲，他在全世界来讲他应该还是第一强权嘛，哦，那可是我觉得在 Peter 的他的想法里面，他自己的认知里面啦，他就对美国的前景非常的不看好。那我觉得我要再强调一点，他虽然是少数看法，但我觉得还是有趣，因为他就是把一些大家以前深信不疑的事情，他就说你觉得真的是这样吗？他就是在问你觉得真的是这样吗？你怎么知道是这样？OK， 我就非常非常有趣啊！来，吉娃娃你嘞？
好，我的 takeaway 有三个。第一个是他在讲他有多讨厌美国大学生的时候，我觉得还蛮有趣的，因为我有回去看很多他在美国校园访问的影片嘛。我记得有一个影片是他在讲 transgender 的事情，就是说跨性别要不要。跨性别者可不可以参与运动赛事这件事情，然后那时候就两边嘛，那你就可以看到有一边的女生她感觉就是她很想要保护 transgender 的权益，所以她很激昂的在发表她的论点，那另外一边的人就是说，哦，我其实没有反对 transgender， 但是我觉得说在比赛上可能还是要因为生理上面的一些差异有一些区别，那是不是我们有一个专属 transgender 的类别。她就发表这样的言论之后，另一边女生就非常生气，她就说你这样就是歧视 transgender， 你就是很恐 transgender 这样子。然后另外一边女生就也很不爽，就说你怎么就这么直接就把这个帽子扣到我身上这样。
对，比如说我只是不同意你的意见，然后我现在就变成歧视了。
对，而且他可能只是在比如特定的地方他觉得可能要有不一样的做法，但是对另外一边来说只要你有稍微不一样你就是歧视，你就是不认同他们。然后我觉得在这个过程里面就可以很明显的感受出来说，其实那些我们相信就是那些相信进步价值的某种程度他其实也很难接纳不同的声音。
这个对于进步派来讲就是一直是一个致命伤，因为我觉得你是我们进步派一直在讲说你要聆听别人的声音，要容纳不同的意见，right？ 所以当这种情况发生的时候我觉得特别自打嘴巴。
对，就是你真的没有在听
你就没有在听别人讲的，啊，而且那个进步派的你不是在讲说他们常常在argue 到一半的时候就会说你有什么，
对，
你有什么学术背景。
对，他那时候就直接问 Peter 说，我知道你可能对于就是性别学的一些专有的概念你不太清楚，然后之后 Peter 就说，哦，我就是性别研究学者，就是他会觉得说你一定要有一些特定的知识背景，或你一定要是比如说我自己就是那个弱势族群你才有资格讨论这些问题。
我自己对这个非常的反对，欸，就是说你只有 trans 才可以讨论 trans related issues，这个太狭隘了吧，真是太狭隘了。
第二个 takeaway 就是我觉得 Peter 方法很灵，就是，
很厉害吧，
就是其实我应该会不太敢跟 Peter 聊天因为我觉得我一定会被他问到很有压力，就是我觉得自己是那种好像别人一问说，哦，真的是这样子吗？你真的这么觉得吗？你为什么这么觉得呢？然后我就会开始就是怀疑自我相信的价值的那种
而且信仰崩坏其实是一个蛮不愉快的经验。
对啊，我也觉得
真的是蛮不愉快的经验，可是我还是觉得这是重要的吧，
是重要的，
我觉得是重要的，时不时还是要自己 challenge 自己一下，你就不要让别人 challenge 你自己，自己 challenge 自己可能比较不会那么难受吧，
就是会让你思考啊。所以像他在提到说他不是问一个 teenager 他对于那个 Miley Cyrus 的看法嘛，他那时候就有说，我只让他从 strongly agree move 到slightly agree， 我不会再继续下去，因为他年纪还小
不要伤害那么大。
对，不要伤害他，就是我觉得蛮有趣的部分。那最后一个就是我觉得Peter 他一直在讲说他认为美国的这种大学体制已经无可救药了，所以他认为唯一的方法呢就是要整个打掉重练。虽然这个方法听起来很极端，但我觉得他很酷的地方就是他也正在做这件事情，就是他跟一些朋友啊就是在2021年的时候建了一个学校叫做 University of Austin， 然后他在今年会有第一批学生入学，就是在秋天的时候。我觉得听到这件事情觉得蛮酷的，
蛮酷的。而且 我自己都会想说，哇，我去参观一下看他怎么教学生，他把别人骂了臭头，对不对？那现在来看看他自己怎么教，
而且他
蛮有趣的。
他办这个学校的目的就是因为他想要挑战美国校园的那种不自由主义，就是做到很不自由的这种氛围，这样我觉得很酷，
很酷，真的很酷。好了，我们今天讨论到这边了。那大家对于这个 Peter 的想法，或是我们两个讲的有什么样的感想，都欢迎留言告诉我们。 然后最后要做一个宣布啊，吉娃娃要离开我们了。
他哭了没有？
吉娃娃要离开，他是告诉大家你为什么要离开团队好了。
主要是因为我之后会有出国读书的计划啦，所以范姐这边就会先告一段落这样子。
嗯，对，但他偶尔还是会，我们比如说
代班
这样人手不足的时候，还是会叫他来救火这样子。可以跟大家讲说你要去哪里读书吗？
我们要去美国。
你是被 Peter 影响吧？
没有，是因为美国太贵，我读不起。
OK， 好啦，那今天对于 Peter 讲的啊，或者是我们两个讲的，真的有意见的话，赶快告诉我们。那喜欢我们节目的话，应该要
订阅、按赞、分享、抖内，
谢谢大家，